Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 59 of Season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and once again, on this lovely Thursday, we are still on location in Baltimore, so my guest-slash-host is Nick Rehak, formerly of French Toast Sunday, and welcome back to the show, and thank you for still having me here.
Thank you for having me back, and you're welcome.
Why not? Well, yeah. It's been a fun road trip.
I can't believe it's day four. It's going to feel like it's almost over, yeah, which I don't like.
Well, that's what it is.
That's how time works.
You got to deal with it. That's it. Nothing you can do there.
Nope.
All right, so Minute 59 begins with a man on the radio, or a man and a radio talking over one another, and ends with John revealing himself. So yesterday's minute ended with, we now know it's Richard Thornburg, mm-hmm. Sitting there on the phone talking to his girlfriend Monica, promising her that he's going to be able to, make sure to get a reservation because he's good friends with Wolfgang. And at this point, we hear the radio, which says, "Officer in need of assistance." And then at the same time, Thornburg is saying, "I interviewed him, for God's sake." And then we hear the radio say again, "Reports of shots fired at Nakatomi, 2000 block Avenue of the Stars. Repeat, officer needs assistance at..." And then we hear Powell, "I'm in Nakatomi Plaza. They're turning my car into Swiss cheese. I need backup assistance now. Now, goddammit, now." And first of all, the fact that they mentioned the Swiss cheese here, this is obviously a different take than what they use for the last minute. I mean, yesterday we were talking about it. He didn't mention anything about Swiss cheese.
No.
He talked about the fact that I'm in Nakatomi and he needs this. I need backup assistance now. Now, goddammit, now. So it's not like he would have said that afterwards.
Well, I think he's finally come down from the adrenaline of it all.
But he's still saying the same thing again.
In the same kind of...
No, he's saying the same... he's saying, now, goddammit, now.
Well, I guess maybe he's trying to...
If he's calmed down, I don't think he would still... Ah, so you're saying this is an addition. This isn't just a different take.
Maybe he wants to really press the point home. So he's like, now let me take it up a notch so they have like a visual of, oh no. Because of the cheese.
Okay, it could be.
Potentially.
It's very possible. So they mentioned Swiss cheese. What do you know about Swiss cheese?
I know it's got holes in it. I think it's a natural occurring hole. And it's got like a... I can't describe the taste, but I know I kind of like it, especially in like a cordon bleu setting. But that's about it.
Okay, that's fair. So Swiss cheese is a variety of cheese that resembles Emmental cheese, a yellow, medium-hard cheese that originated in the area around Emmental, Switzerland. It is classified as a Swiss-type or Alpine cheese. Some types of Swiss cheese have a distinctive appearance as the blocks or rounds of cheese are riddled with holes, mm-hmm. known as eyes. Swiss cheese without eyes is known as blind. That's really interesting.
That's rude.
So Swiss cheese without holes is known as blind Swiss cheese. Interesting. So they use three different types of bacteria to produce Swiss cheese. I'm going to try to pronounce these. I don't really know if I'm going to. There's Streptococcus salivarius, subspecies thermophilus. Okay, maybe.
Sure.
That's one. Second one is Lactobacillus. The third one is Propionibacterium. Okay. In the late stage of cheese production, the Propionibacteria consumes the lactic acid excreted by the other bacteria and that releases acetate, propionic acid, and carbon dioxide gas.
Really?
And the carbon dioxide slowly forms the bubbles that eventually develop the eyes.
Okay, so it is naturally occurring. That's good.
Yeah. The acetate and propionic acid give Swiss its nutty and sweet flavor.
Mm.
A hypothesis proposed by Swiss researchers in 2015, notes that particular matter may also play a role in a hole's development, and that modern sanitation eliminates debris such as hay dust in the milk plays a role in reducing hole size in Swiss cheese or even blind cheese.
Hay dust? Okay. Yeah.
Historically, the holes were seen as a sign of imperfection, and cheesemakers originally tried to avoid them by pressing during production. The holes only became an identifier of the cheese in modern times. In general, the larger the eyes in the Swiss cheese, the more pronounced its flavor, because a longer fermentation period gives the bacteria more time to act. Okay. I don't know, it just sounds weird to be eating food that's, you know, created via bacteria. You know, when you think of bacteria, you don't think of good things.
No, you think of, like, I need penicillin or I need something.
That's right. You think you're going to get sick from it.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds to me.
It's just funny how it works sometimes.
Yeah. So it says that this poses a problem because cheese with large eyes doesn't slice as well and comes apart when using mechanical slicers. As a result, the U.S. industry regulators have reduced the minimum eye size with which Swiss cheese can receive a grade A stamp.
Huh.
Wow.
All because it's inconvenient for some people?
Apparently.
So absurd.
So, okay, here's a question for you. In 2014, this is the year I was able to get the data from.
Okay.
How many pounds of Swiss cheese were reportedly produced in the U.S.?
Produced in the U.S.?
Yes. In 2014.
In pounds. I'm going to say, and I'm probably low on this, I'm going to say 25,000 pounds.
You are very low. It's 297.8 million pounds.
What? I was way off. Oh my. I just figure if it's a Swiss, like, we'd be importing it, it'd be predominantly over there, and we'd be focused on more like here, American. And
if they're making it here.
Jeez. So
I don't know.
That's so much.
That's a lot.
I was way low. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And there are two kinds of American Swiss cheese, which are known as Baby Swiss and Lacy Swiss.
Okay.
They're two different varieties of American Swiss cheese.
All right. I'll take it.
Lacy Swiss is used with low-fat milk, and Baby Swiss is made with whole milk.
All right.
They were developed in the mid-60s in Ohio.
Okay. I can see that.
Yeah.
Because really, I mean, a lot of people would think, like, the Midwest for cows, but Ohio's got a lot of cows, New Jersey has a lot of cows, like, it's interesting. Well,
when you think of cheese, you think of Wisconsin.
That, too. You think of a little bit north, where there's more trees.
Yeah.
Not alpines, we have conifers, but I guess an alpine is kind of a conifer. It don't matter.
Right. So, as Thornburg is listening to this call on the radio, you know, you see on his face that he gets really, really excited about what's going on, and basically forgets about the fact that he's on the phone with his girlfriend. Or with Monica, whoever she is that he's supposed to be going out on a date with. You know, so it's pretty funny, though, that, you know. And at this point, we see that the cavalry is finally arriving. There are multiple police cars that show up and immediately cut off the roads, you know, around Nakatomi. And at this point, we also get to hear lots of police sirens that are happening. And, you know, even inside of Nakatomi, they get to see it. And then we get Ellis, who we haven't seen in a while.
Mm-hmm.
He shows up and he goes, "I never thought I'd love to hear that sound."
Oh, that guy. Ugh.
I mean, it's funny that you'd actually hear him say this. I mean, he says it to Holly, but it's funny that Ellis would say it because he doesn't look like the type of guy who, in any situation, would be happy that the police are there.
That's true.
You know?
Because I'm sure he's got something
better
on him.
Better than with terrorists, but
yeah,
still.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
You know? Because he does look like someone who, you know, breaks the laws besides just doing drugs.
Yeah, I break. He's probably like, "Oh, I'm bending it." No, he's breaking it. Like, for sure he's breaking it.
I mean, we talked about this weeks ago, but, you know, if this was taking place now, he would have been, you know, cited for sexual harassment quite often.
And then promoted to a management, because that's how that works for some bizarre reason. Wouldn't be let go.
I don't know,
he would just be
right up the ranks. Or in 1988.
All right, 1998. This time, he would definitely be let go very quickly.
Yeah, nowadays, it wouldn't work so well for him.
No.
Which is good.
No, absolutely. That's how it should be.
That's how it should have been.
That's correct.
So, what do you know about police sirens? Or just the term siren in general?
I know sirens have been changing. sirens, usually they're a little bit louder, but I know when it comes to, like, fire or ambulances, it used to be a loud police-like siren, but now it's these, like, deep, like, wave pulses kind of thing that really catch you off guard. And I think it's because people with music nowadays, they play a little bit louder. They're, you know, I think it's not really hearing up, so that deeper, like, very sound, like you're not anticipating, it kind of startles you to where you look around and you see what's going on.
Right.
But I just know that it's loud. Okay. And it should be loud.
Right. So, but do you know the original connotation of the word siren?
Like song.
Okay.
Song. When I hear siren, I think of like the mermaids that would sing songs.
That's right. And that there you go.
Yeah, all right.
There you go.
Getting something.
So the first known use of the word siren as a noun was in the 14th century. And it can be defined in three different ways. It can either be any of the group of female or partly human creatures in Greek mythology that lured mariners to destruction by their singing.
I'm nailing it.
There you go. Whew. You got it. A woman who sings with enchanting sweetness, a temptress or okay. temptation.
Okay.
Or a device often electronically operated for producing a penetrating warning sound.
Mm.
Okay. As an adjective, okay, the word was first used in 1568, and it meant to entice or arousing strong attraction or interest.
Hmm.
And that's pretty much what a police siren does. Because sirens generate loud tones, mm-hmm. which attract everyone's attention to take necessary measures to ensure the safety of the first responders and the public at large.
Yeah.
You know, the idea, you hear a siren, you're supposed to move out of the way.
Yep.
Or you're supposed to pull over, mm-hmm. or whatever it is. You know, they're letting you know that something's happening.
Yeah.
You know, when do you think emergency vehicles in the U.S. started using sirens?
1962.
Okay, it's a little bit later than that. It's, according to this, it only started in the early 70s.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
And this included police sirens, which started in the early 70s. But they did use sirens beforehand during wartime in order to alert soldiers and citizens alike of various scenarios that they need to be alert about, or dangers, or an all clear
air, like an air raid.
Air raid, yeah. Exactly, those type of things. But having the sirens on the police cars, mm-hmm. according to what I found, it only started in the 1970s. I was trying to think if I've seen like movies or anything like that that took place in the 50s or 60s that had people with sirens, but yeah. I can't think of that. Maybe ambulances.
Mm. Maybe ambulances.
Like the one thing I can think of is maybe in the Dirty Dozen, but that's World War II.
You know, right,
and which an ambulance that apropos. They had, you know, I don't know.
Now, were they hand crank sirens at first, or did they have a button?
I believe they had a button. It doesn't mention that here, but
well, it would have to be a button if it's on a car. It's a little bit smaller. Right. Like you couldn't have somebody, especially if you're by yourself. You couldn't be trying to drive.
The air raid sirens were definitely hand cranked. They have various different types of sirens that they use on cars,
mm-hmm.
on different police cars and stuff like that.
Right on.
I mean, police cars in the 1940s, you would have like a single beacon that would attract people's attention and let them know that an official vehicle is approaching, but that's just the light. It wasn't really a siren.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know. So when the light was turned on, the drivers knew that they had to move out of the way.
Okay.
You know, yeah. But there wasn't really a siren, mm-hmm. that was added to that. And they decided eventually that it made more sense to add a siren there also. You know, so I guess so people could hear and not just see that. Because I guess having the flashing light works at night much better than during the day from that perspective. If you're telling people to get out of the way.
Yeah. It works better at night. And I'm noticing a little bit more in certain areas, cop cars, they'll be riding by without a siren. Just the lights flashing, especially if it's not as congested, because they don't want people to know that they're coming.
Right.
Like, for that area, they're just kind of sneaking up on them. Which is, I think, is a little dangerous, because if you're not paying attention, you could get hit if there's no, you know, if you're not really paying attention or there's no siren. But
right. And here I found something that's connected to what you said. Okay, compared to police lights, sirens are less efficient, mostly because they generate sound that can easily be muffled by other surrounding sounds, including loud music that most drivers are listening to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that You know, so that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why they're also trying to change. Like I said, some ambulances now have that like weird, like deep pulse kind of thing, and fire trucks just have that loud, almost like a railroad horn. They're just loud,
right?
That's true. It's terrifying to see this huge, like literally just tank coming down at you. It's like, oh no!
Right, and also another of the issues is that, you know, putting the lights and sirens on cars make them heavier. And the whole idea is a police car.
I would have never thought that.
Is supposed to be able to go as fast as possible.
I would have never thought about
that. So they had to change the whole aerodynamics of what the type of cars they use.
I focus on aluminum, LED now instead of bulbs and glass.
Yeah, things that are lighter.
Yeah.
You know. Okay. And you know, the automotive industry itself evolved, and you know, they wanted to make everything also more aerodynamic for, you know, for drivers,
mm-hmm.
not just police,
right?
Not just for emergency vehicles, but for other vehicles also. So that really works. All right. So they cut off the street. Ellis is happy to hear it, and then we, you know, then we get Hans. He's basically in the room with a bunch of his men. We don't know how many. We don't know who. We were only focusing on Hans,
mm-hmm.
and he basically needs to find a way to calm down his men. You know, and the best thing, the thing that I love about that is it once again shows that Hans is the one he's the only one who knows the full plan.
Yeah.
Nobody else knows the plan.
Right.
Nobody else, you know, they might all know bits and pieces,
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that, but there's no one besides Hans that is aware entirely of everything that's going on. You know, so, I mean, they had to put a lot of trust in Hans here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I'm willing to bet he had, like, 80% of it planned out, and the other 20, he's, like, making it up as he goes. And he's just, like, hard pivots here and there. Some things he's obviously expecting, like, the police and stuff, but I think there's other things where he's like, I'm going to do this instead and make it look like part of the plan.
Well, I wonder what his original plan was, is how to get the police involved.
Well, I think he knew it was just going to happen eventually. Someone was going to say something, somebody, you know, with guns, somebody nearby would hear it, and they'd have to call it in.
Right. No, because what he says here is, you know, his line to his men is, all of you relax. This is a matter of inconvenient timing, that's all. Police action was inevitable, and as it happens, necessary. So let them fumble around outside and stay calm. This is simply the beginning.
Well, thinking ahead a little bit, and this is going to be a little spoilery, and it might, obviously you guys are going to cover this later on. Later, they're unloading an old-school ambulance. So I think their getaway plan the whole time was to leave in that ambulance where they might come across a little bit of police contact, especially when they, you know, have the explosions later on.
Okay, well, I'll let you in on a little secret.
Mm-hmm.
The original idea of the movie, they didn't know how they were going to get out of the building when they started filming the movie. During filming, that's when they started making changes. I mean, we haven't gotten to the script yet. I'm curious what's going to be in the script
right
when we get there, about at what point they, you know, if it'll mention it. But if you notice, when they first get to Nakatomi and you see them all in the back of the truck,
mm-hmm.
there is no ambulance there.
Right, right. They just kind of...
They were somehow able to transport, they you know, miraculously transported, teleported the ambulance into the back, of there, because it wasn't there.
Huh. Okay.
You know, it was something that was added later on into the plot.
Interesting. Okay.
So,
okay.
And it makes sense, because the idea for is, sure. okay, if the building is collapsed,
yeah.
and, you know, you have emergency vehicles leaving, so it makes sense that's how they would try to get out of there.
Smart.
You know, by using that. Smart, but, you know, they didn't think of it when they filmed the first part of it. that's the one problem with the whole thing. You know, and... What's very interesting here the whole time is, you know, we hear static on the radio,
mm-hmm.
and then he picks up the radio and goes, I thought I told all of you I want radio silence until further. And part of the whole thing is that we never heard him say this. You know, if John is walking around with the walkie-talkie, he should have heard it. And, like, when would he have said this? He would have said it right after, you know, I don't know, right after Tony died. At what point would he have asked for radio silence?
When did he get the walkie? Was that pre...
He got it after he killed Tony.
Right, after the ho-ho-ho.
No, before the ho-ho-ho.
Before, that's what I mean, before the ho-ho-ho.
Right.
So he definitely would have heard it. Because the only time I can think is when the cop guy was coming in. He's like, hey, radio silence. But even then, as he's coming in, the guys are running down to go get McClane.
Right. Exactly, because he says until further notice, and mm-hmm. like it doesn't. It's not as if he says, "I told you that throughout this entire mission, radio silence."
Right.
If he would have said that, okay, I would completely understand that. But he didn't say that. He says, "You know, I told you radio silence until further notice." Meaning, at some point, he said, "All right, we have a problem here. Don't talk on the radio." You know, it's possible that someone can be listening in, or whatever the case is. Actually, he knows that McClane has a radio because McClane went up on the roof. And, you know, called for 911, General 9.
Yeah.
So at some point over the course of this time, he mentioned that he wants radio silence, but John didn't hear it.
Huh.
I mean, forget about the fact that we didn't hear it.
Right. John, yeah, because, okay. So it had to have happened at some point, but McClane, like you said, would have been aware because he'd have heard it.
Yeah.
And then maybe he would have messed with them sooner.
Right.
And, like, you know, making noises and stuff like that to, okay.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, and then John responds, "Oh, I'm very sorry, Hans." You know, a very smart-ackly way for him to, you know, take things. And it works really well. I mean, one of the things that you know, that makes this movie so amazing is the performance of Bruce Willis. You know, he is able to do things in this movie that many action stars at the time would not have been able to do. And that was the idea also of keeping things light and fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, despite the fact that we're dealing with a theoretical terrorist plot. You know. But, you know, he adds a lot of humor into his situation, into things that he says, into things that he does. You know, and it works. You know, I like the way that he adds to the whole thing by doing that. And, you know, just... I mean, we'll see more of it even tomorrow.
Right.
But today, just by him starting and by saying, you know, "Oh, I'm very sorry, Hans." You know, Hans is a little taken aback by it. He's not really sure what to believe and what to understand about everything that's going on.
I think what helps it, too, is it all feels genuine. None of it feels hokey. None of it feels forced. It feels like he would say this exact kind of stuff back in New York as a cop. Than as he obviously says it now.
Right.
So I think that really helps.
Right. And I love the fact that when Hans is talking, you can see that he has like his philo, Filofax or whatever it's called.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Open on the side where he's got, you know, all his notes written. He used that, you know, when he was talking to Takagi at the beginning. You can't read what it says. It's all out of focus, unfortunately.
But you do have some drawings.
But you can see, exactly. His whole plan is in this little book. You know, my biggest qualm about it was at the beginning when he used it about Takagi, where he was talking about, you know, all his entire resume.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't have a picture of Takagi.
That's true. So how
he has all of the information about him except for a picture. You know, that's the type of thing that you think that he would have had there. But it looks really well. And then on the other side of him, it looks like he's got like a portable printer or something like that.
Portable printer, some kind of weird.
Oh no, that's the TV. I think that's the TV they brought him, where he was listening. You know, oh no, they don't bring the TV. No, he brings the TV later.
Yeah, unless that was already on the desk to begin with, and she was packing it up when she went to leave. Holly,
maybe she takes the TV home.
Almost looks like a projector too, the way the bulbs sit there.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, we'll have to wait and see what that is. Maybe it's not the... Right, the TV is actually... maybe in 2 weeks they actually take the TV out. But maybe what they do is they take the TV out of the bag.
Could be. And I think you're right that it's the TV, because if we zoom in a little bit, there's the screen. Assumedly, it looks like a screen. And then there's an antenna right there. And then a handle to carry it around with. So I'm going to think it is the TV. Maybe those are batteries, like the big, like C or D batteries.
Right. Okay. So they brought this with them and put it on the table. You know, they're waiting to use it. They don't need to use it yet, and that's what. Wow, that is really cool. Because like I think in another week and a half we'll actually see the TV itself. But you know, you and I were talking about the fact that they have things in this movie that are foreshadowing, you know, other things that are going to happen later on. You can find tools that will be used later.
Mm-hmm,
so here's another clear example of that. So that's really cool.
That is.
Well, for some reason, I thought it was a printer at first, but for sure it's not a printer.
I mean, you especially know, because of that little slot there where it looks like something would come out, but then it's a handle.
Wow. Okay, that's really, really cool. And that's pretty much how this minute ends.
Yeah.
So, do you have anything else you want to say about this minute?
Yeah, I think Ellis's character is super slimy. His laugh earlier was obnoxious.
Just wait.
Yeah, that's the other part. But overall, this is another hype minute. This is where we're coming down from what just happened, and we're getting ready to really just kick off the film. Like, really get into the meat and potatoes of it. Because from this point forward, we're going. We're balls to the wall. We're rocking and rolling. We're not stopping.
Right. Completely.
Yeah.
No question about that. All right, so the script has some differences in the dialogue, which in some ways I like it better in the script. So, first of all, we hear on the police scanner, it says, "Attention all units, officer pinned down by automatic weapon fire at Nakatomi Century City, request assistance." And then Powell says on the radio, "Guys, you want to cut through the red tape? They practically turned this car into Swiss cheese." Which makes more sense because, as we were discussing earlier, it sounds more like a different take where he goes, "Now, goddammit, now." Yeah. If he would have just said something like this afterwards, okay, that makes sense. You know, he's not panicking. He's saying it in a normal way. And then Thornburg drops the phone that he's talking to Monica on. Mm-hmm. He picks up another phone and says, "Mary, this is Dick. I want a remote truck and a crew to meet me at the South Gate in 15 minutes. Damn right, 15. Where are we going? For an Emmy." Okay. It didn't need to be there. That's fine. But it's just very funny. And then he, just leaves the room. And we hear on the other phone, Richard, you know, meaning that he cares more about his profession than Monica.
Yeah.
Again, whoever she is, whether it's a first date, whether it's a 50th date, it doesn't make a difference. Whether it's his wife, you know, who knows?
That too.
You know, he just completely leaves her hanging, pun intended.
He's just so focused on getting in front of the camera and success. And you can see with his eyes that line about the Emmy and wanting that award. In his eyes, he's like, "Oh, this is what's going to put me over the top. I'm going to be the one behind the desk."
Right. I mean, later on, he does have a comment, you know, "Channel 5, eat your heart out," mm-hmm, or something mm-hmm. like that. You know, but... And then we see that it talks about here... that Hans says to his men, "All of you, stay at your posts. We knew that police action was inevitable," right? Meaning he must have mentioned it to them at some point or whatever. And then it says he gives an odd smile and then says, "In fact, it's necessary. So let them start their feeble efforts." Instead of in the script here, he says that let them fumble about outside. But their feeble efforts until then... "Stay calm. We have hostages, remember. We are still in charge." Again, it's more effective the way that they do it in the movie. Yeah. It doesn't need to change.
The other one feels really rigid.
Yeah. Yeah. And then after he talks about the fact that, you know, he says, I wanted radio silence. So then it says about John. It says, John's got a CB on the table, flipped to on. And his cop's notebook is out again. He's already upgraded the number of terrorists. To 12 with a question mark minus 3 equals 9 and added other information. As he speaks, he takes ammo clips from the dead men who dropped and their sidearms, etc. And he goes, "Gee, I'm sorry, Hans." So, yeah, I mean, I think it's great to see that, you know, that he's taking notes on things. We don't need to see it, but it's still nice. You know, to see that, because earlier he had marked down, I think, 5 terrorists.
Right,
he wrote
right.
down a few of the names. So here he's like, okay, now I know that it's 12. I don't know how he knows it's 12.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that even if it's just a question mark, you know, how would he know that?
I think he knows it from when he starts, I mean, you can't really see it in the scene, but when he's drawing on his arm, he's got a couple hash marks, and then he has specific names on there.
No, for sure, that he does, but he only gets up to 5 or 6 there. Like, how does he jump now to 12? He only encountered 2 people. He encountered, you know, Franco and Heinrich, who he killed both of them. You know, he doesn't know. So even if he were to add 2, he has to add 6. I mean, part of the thing that always makes me laugh about this movie is in every single advertisement, it says 12 terrorists, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know that there are 13?
If you count Hans.
He's not. Oh, because he's not the Rester terrorist. He's not.
Yeah,
he's the thief.
Yeah, I'm just the mastermind. All right, I'm the exceptional thief.
Right, the exceptional thief. All right, that works. That works. All right. You have anything else you want to say about this minute?
No, I'm all set, ready for the next one.
Not yet.
But I'm chomping at the bit for tomorrow for sure.
Okay, great. We'll have to get there.
Yeah.
So every Thursday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track Holiday Edition, where my guest will give a story about an adventure, a misadventure, something fun that happened to them, or it could also not be fun, mm-hmm. but some story that happened to them at some point during the journey of life, around, related somehow to some sort of holiday.
Yeah.
So you got another story for us, Nick?
I do. It's actually a bit of a compilation story.
Go ahead.
I don't do well on Christmas Eves. I'll be 33 in September, at least half of them. I've been sick in one way, shape, or another. When I was 3 years old, I fell back on a rocking chair and split my head open on brick. And had to go get stitches. And whenever I asked what Santa got me for Christmas, I said he got me stitches, which everybody thought was adorable.
Sounds funny, I gotta say.
Yeah.
Even now, he got me stitches.
I always had like some little bit for some reason. When I was 8 or 9 years old, I was kind of sitting in the corner not talking to anybody, and my aunt came by and she's like, Nick, what's wrong? And I said, I'm not feeling very jolly today. And then apparently a couple minutes later, I just threw up everywhere.
Ooh.
This past Christmas, I spent it here in the basement, because the wife had COVID and then I had COVID. Although she had it way worse than I did. I feel like I just had like sinus pressure stuff, but the test said COVID, so COVID it is. And then 3 Christmases ago, I had food poisoning. Very, very intense food poisoning.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I think you need to avoid, I think you need to skip December every year.
Yeah, at this point. And I should have known better because it was Taco Bell. And yeah. So I did it to myself unintentionally.
You could have just said that. That's
but but yeah, Christmas Eve's for some reason I don't do well. I don't know what it is. I feel like I should just Zoom or Skype or something in.
There you go. There you go. It's that Taco Bell.
Yeah.
All right. Great. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
All right. You want to once again tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Absolutely. Over on Twitter, at the Rehack, T-H-E-R-E-H-A-K. You can also find me, Rehack Radio, my program I have over on Mixcloud.com. It's me. We're hanging out. We're listening to music. And about an hour-ish, and I think it's a really good time.
All right. Great. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcatcher you might be using to listen to this show. You can find me very simply by doing a search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter, or you can go to my website, which is movieroundminute.com. So, Nick, you feel like having me one more night this week?
Absolutely. I wouldn't have it any other way.
All right, great. So, until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.